Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to yet another Rahal Mustafa Book Club. I'm delighted to be joined by an old associate of mine from many years ago, David Wollstonecroft, who's written a few books, but his most recent book is, I believe, his first children's book. He will correct me if I'm wrong. It's called The Magic Hour. It's very good. Hello, David.
Hello, Richard. It's lovely to see you.
Really lovely to see you. I mean, you are I haven't been doing this on the book club, but you are obviously best known for playing an auditioning vicar in Fist of Fun. That was
it's the high ground. I call it the high ground. It's the moment. Yeah. It's like the high plateau of and you know, I have to say, it is an iconic show, and I was very happy to even be minutely and to be a microscopic dot on the firmament of you guys.
It seems to be a role that pretty much killed your acting career off.
I think rightly. I think justly. I think it's like a litmus test or it's like the COVID test. Funny, not funny. Sorry, mate. It's on the NF. The bar's on the NF.
So tell us, I mean, you have a very prestigious career as a writer, but please tell us, for anyone who doesn't know you, David, could you tell us a little bit about what you have done in the interim?
Sure. In the interim. So I suppose I'm best known for, I created a TV show called Spooks, which ran on the BBC for 10 seasons, as we call it.
Yeah, fantastic.
In the business, not series, apparently. For which I am eternally grateful and had tons of fun. And in the interim, I've sort of, after that, I did a show with David Tennant called The Escape Artist, which was wonderful. And a show called Versailles with Simon Mirren, which was set in the court of Louis XIV. So it's a clear progression.
Yeah, but like a very successful TV writing career, which I'm very envious of having. I mean, I had a couple of things on the telly, but to make something that goes for many series, Spooks is a while ago, but it's a very well remembered and loved series. There was some spin-offs from it and all sorts, wasn't there?
So there were all sorts of things that happened. I think it started the careers of, or at least one would hope, helped the careers of quite a few people. I mean, Matthew McFadyen, David Oyelowo, the wonderful Keeley Hawes, Richard Armitage, Rupert Penry-Jones. We also had Benedict Cumberbatch as a sort of uncredited, baddie. So it was one of these things where it's like, oh, I enjoyed working with you in X. I'm like, I'm not sure I was there that day, but you're a massive star now, so thank you very much for coming to play.
It's a little bit like Vista Fun. Vista Fun was the...
Well, it's precisely the same.
The comedy exactly equivalent what I was going to say. Everyone else has gone on to be very successful. Yes, that's
like, yeah, Mount Olympus. And you and Stu were on top, and we were clambering up the slope. And, not me, I was in the gutter.
And then you have written a couple of books for adults. I'm right that this is your first kids book, right?
Yes, it is. It is. It is. I never went towards kids fiction just because I thought it was too hard. It is such a precise science, in my opinion. It's, you know, I wrote two spy thrillers for grown-ups, and I enjoyed the process. There's a lot of words. I'm sure you've had, I think I heard, was it Steve Mangan you had on talking about his wonderful Father Changed the World. I think there's a sort of when you've done a lot of script writing over the story is fine and you could sort of haiku it a bit. There's a kind of, and we put that there and then there's a bit with a dog and then off you go. But the writing is like, you know, this extremely needy page that keeps wanting to be serviced in some way. And it's really, it's physical labor, I find.
Yeah.
So not that it's actual work, let's be honest, but it's not real work. But it is definitely hard work. It's sweaty work.
Yeah. Do you find, I mean, I found writing books to be harder than writing TV comedy. I mean, I know you're writing, you know, drama, which I don't know how, if that's harder or easier. So you're finding writing books a lot harder than writing a TV series?
Yeah, it's the hardest thing I've done. I think it's definitely the most satisfying, and it's definitely the hardest. Yeah. And then doing it for the completely unblinking, cold stare judgment of a child, who my own child, for example, who I kind of, you know, wrote it for, who read it but was reading Skandar and preferring Skandar, let's be honest. And that's kind of a moment in a parent's life.
Yeah, it is a difficult. My wife writes kids books, and my daughter's started reading those, though I think she has enjoyed them, I have to say. But yeah, she's big into David Walliams. I'm disappointed.
Yes, who isn't?
So it's a crowded marketplace, children's books, but obviously if you get it right, it can be a very lucrative marketplace.
I'm told by people with lots of money. But I think it's also, you know, in the country. I don't live in Britain normally, but I'm sort of more and more here for various personal reasons. But I'm producing a play. I don't know if you know this. Bleak Expectations at the Criterion, as is big. Yeah, and that process, I'm not writing it, I'm just one of the producers, to see, again, that's something I've never done. Never. I mean, you and I did back in the day of, you know, Fringe and performance and comedy, but that raw comedy, not something that's artfully done. And that, again, has its own energy because there's other people involved.
Yeah.
And I think it's that sense of, I have nothing but admiration for people who write books, because it is simply you and the screen and your ability to hit those keys accurately, which I'm increasingly unable to do. And or doing the thing, do you ever do dictation?
Oh, I haven't done. You know, I need to write it down. You know, I'm terrible. I mean, I'm terrible at taping stand up and listening back to stuff. Sometimes tape it but never listen back to it. But right. I mean, maybe I should do that. It's, you know, I understand that could work, and I often my ideas come like at some point we think, why don't I just record this? But I've never got into it.
But you feel kind of like note to self, idea for a movie. Kind of, right? It's not.
It's a bit
edifying. Exactly.
But yeah,
Deliberate Partridge.
But I kind of need to sit down and try and write. And then often, you know, like weirdly, the book I wrote, which I have discussed this, but when kind of have my ball back, which was obviously autobiography about something that happened to me, which was.
And commiserations. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. But that did come like incredibly easier. But all the other books I've written, you know, even comedy books, even books that are autobiography, I have struggled to hit deadlines, and I've done it all very last minute. But that book sort of flowed very nicely, and I don't really remember the process of sitting down writing. I think it was just there was just, you know, I needed to get it out, and it just came out, and it came out pretty much straight away, you know. But
that's
yeah,
great.
But mostly, as Adam Buxton was very annoyed when I told him that. But but mostly, it's a struggle, and yeah, whenever I've sat down and tried to come up with a novel or a, you know, comedy story, I struggle a lot more with that. But
I think it's a unique muscle. It's like climbing the Matterhorn in flip flops. Nobody recommends doing that, and you need particular muscles to carry it off. And it's sort of you just have to. Every time you go up, you're sliding back down again. That's what I find. I do a brick by brick approach, and then get imposter syndrome very quickly, and then have to sort of retreat.
It's good to hear that. This book is very well constructed, and I can imagine took a lot of time to put together, because it's a complex concept, incorporating a lot of themes and a lot of conflicting worlds that need to be resolved, and it's about time and relationships, and you know, there's a lot in there, so I can imagine. And you were creating this world. Why did you want to write? Why did you want to? Was it just for your own child, or
I'm obsessed with time. My publisher would say it's a very singular sort of high concept book, in the way that it's about there being an extra hour in the day that's hidden from all of us. And this girl, Ailsa Craig, who lives in Edinburgh, who's always late and relatably late and disorganized and feels that everybody else is, you know, has more time and is more together, finds it in this parallel Edinburgh. And of course it comes at a cost, and don't take this the wrong way, anybody listening, but it was sort of Marcel Proust meets Raiders of the Lost Ark in my head as a kind of, it's something about time, but it's not going to be hectoring, you know, philosophy, at least I hope it isn't, something that was a page turner. And there's 60 chapters because it's 60 minutes an hour. So I had this sort of organizing principle in my head. And so there was a moment when my daughter, who was in kindergarten, I guess that's like primary one, went back to her nursery playground and got nostalgic. And I remember thinking, that's interesting. And I thought, well, actually, that's completely honest, because she is aware of what's going on. That slide is smaller. And I thought, I wonder how she experiences time. And time is something that I'm obsessed with. And I hate wasting time. And I try my best to be on time and all of those things. And then I thought that would be a way of doing a thriller about time that was about that lost time. And then the pandemic hit, of course, and then everybody's losing time. Yeah. In various ways, and time became, I mean, it feels like half an hour ago that you and I were in the Pleasance courtyard talking about, you know, Arthur Smith's set or something. Yeah. And yet it is, unfortunately, at least several years ago. And but it's all warped. So I feel very much more connected to, maybe it's just being elderly now, I guess, but like going back in time was a very emotional thing for me. I get nostalgic as well. So I think that's where it all came from. So I wanted to tell a story about a girl who's late, who finds an extra hour, and it's not what she thinks, and there's a big price, and then it becomes a thriller, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's that concept of, because a lot of the people who have this extra hour turn out to be sort of famous and successful people who you would look at and go, how do they do? You know, you still do. Yeah. You go, how do they do? And the answer is they have people doing all the shitty little stuff for them.
Right, have an inside track. it's a sort of privilege thing, isn't it? I never understood how people get their starts in the industry, or how did you get from there to there in 12 months? Like, I'm like on housing benefit at the time. Like, how on earth did that happen? But but thank you. It's definitely. I'm writing the second book now, which is also about time, but in a different way. So I'm trying to, you know, annex that theme a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm fascinated. I've always been fascinated with time travel. There's a little bit of time travel in this, and there's, it's Kurt Vonnegut, isn't it? That sort of the juddering way time feels like it's, you know, it's fractals and exact thing you're talking about. That, you know, like someone just tweeted today, the day we're recording this, or yesterday, that it's 21 years since Time Gentlemen, Please Finish.
Yes.
And you kind of go, what? And obviously it's like 30 years since, you know, some of the stuff we're talking about happened. And that, you know, it just the way time concertinas and feels in different ways. I find it all fascinating, the mechanics whether time travel would be possible or not. And also, those are things I think about a lot.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Obviously, Edinburgh is a big part of this, and I'm guessing that the sort of mysterious city under Edinburgh was a little bit of an influence, but maybe it wasn't. You know, there's under the old town,
layers and layers and layers of Edinburgh. It's actually, I discovered this interesting, I think it's an interesting fact, it was for me, that, you know, on the bridge, on George IV Bridge down in the Cowgate, there's the sort of, by the National Gallery, there's obviously a big drop down to the Cowgate. You'd go to the Gilded Balloon along there, and in the old days, the sort of the that was a zone of control for people interested in comedy, and that used to be an entirely different neighborhood, and parts of Edinburgh were just taken away when the new town was being built. And so there's a kind of middle town, which is where the middle market, this sort of fictional world, came about, was being something that there's all these layers of old Edinburgh that I think when you walk around, you just feel there. And I've always thought Edinburgh is this standing set, that I don't know why everything isn't set there, because I grew up there, so I'm biased. But I think it's a beautiful place with so many secrets and nooks and crannies and closes. Yeah. It made a lot of sense.
Yeah. Obviously, J.K. Rowling is famously associated with Edinburgh as well, so it's quite a bold decision to go with Edinburgh. But I can understand why that it was the inspiration for this.
Well, and that, and also there's a bit of Scottish folklore in there that I felt was really I felt an affinity with, and you know, it's not like Ian Rankin's Edinburgh, who, you know, he's completely owns the crime syndicate part of it and the sort of the law and order of it. And I guess, I mean, Harry Potter isn't really set there. No. So it felt like it was something that I was really drawn to and knew. So.
Yeah. No, well, that's clear. And it is, you know, and that the whole of Edinburgh is fascinating. But that, yeah, going into that, was it called St. Mary's Wine? Is that, you know,
St. Mary's Wine, yeah.
Is it? Yeah. So it's all kind of. In fact, I think Ian Boldsworth in his ghost film, they go there and Barry gets very scared and sees a ghost.
Yes.
thinks he sees a ghost in that particular place. But it is a very creepy, when you go look. I mean, I love stuff like that. I love the idea of hidden cities and, you know, the ossuaries and stuff underneath European towns and stuff.
Yes.
So it is, you know, it is ripe for the picking. And what I love about this book, and what I found fascinating about this book, is the way it sort of combines myth and presumably, I haven't looked all of it up, but I've looked up some of it and I realised that like a lot of it is genuine Scottish myth with science. So there's a real feeling of scientific method. There's Newtonian laws of motion and physics and stuff in there.
Yeah.
So it's sort of treating both myth and science with sort of equal reverence, and allowing them to live side by side, which I think is a really lovely idea.
Thank you. No, it's sort of, you know, I wanted there to be some kind of grounding for the fantasy. It's not a kind of, and then a bubble came along and took her away into a fantasy land, which is perfectly legitimate and great, but not for me. I sort of need to have, I'm one of those writers who kind of goes onto Google Maps and walks the route to find out how long it would take to go between X and Y. And then you're in production and it's like, never mind, we'll set it in a toilet. Like, oh, fuck. Okay. Fair enough. But I need to know how the mechanics work for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, but the scientific method stuff's interesting. I guess the stuff as well, without going too much into detail, but there's an element there of the way history has wiped out the female voices and female scientists who've created, who've made great discoveries. And so there's a character who sort of, who takes the research of the grandmother of the main character. And so that's obviously something you care about as well from the
book. No, it absolutely is. No, it's the, you know, I think so much of science is quite brutal, and people generally, women in general, were sort of pushed to the side over the years, and I thought it was an opportunity to, again, it's like I wanted to hang enough things on the adventure to feel that it was something that, you know, when you're a parent, you're reading to your kid, you're going to be telling the story, but there's also about something else. And then as they get older, I started this book when my daughter was 8, and then just life took over for a wee bit, and then by the time it was finished, she's not particularly interested in that genre anymore. I mean, she is, but she's more interested in other themes. And so I think I may have just sort of along the way dug a little deeper as I went about stuff like that. But hopefully in a coherent whole of some description.
What's great about it, and I think, you know, obviously, I've read quite a few children's books as a child, but also as a parent. And I think it's, you know, a lot of the very successful ones are very derivative of other ideas. And this one, for both the idea of having that extra hour and the world you've created to explain that. As you say, you've incorporated some ideas from Scottish myth,
the Brolican. That's not somebody you want to meet on a dark night. That for sure was something that, you know, you always want to have a good baddie. There's a great human baddie, but that as a malevolent entity who isn't too scary. Kids who are listening to this, by the way, why are you listening to this? But it's that sense of, I guess, the loss of control. The more you look into that myth, the more it is like deep, like any fairy tale, like, or any folk tale, like, at its base, deeply disturbing.
Yeah.
And it has a real world sense of, you know, somebody being taken away from you psychologically or losing yourself in a mood. And so I thought that was quite a relatable tween thing as well. The sense that you're possessed by some mood or feeling. And when you, again, some of the stories are quite extraordinary. Some of the I can't remember the name now, but there's this compendium of old Scottish folk tales that I looked into, and there's just some absolutely cracking stories going through with all these. And I thought, well, this is sort of unused material that you could sort of bring in legitimately into this world. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is quite, you know, I don't think it's too scary, but it's quite a scary book. And there's a real sense of dread beneath it all, because you know something's going on. You know, it becomes pretty clear early on something's going on. There's some there's some debt to be paid, or there's something.
No such thing as a free lunch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not a free hour. And so, you know, there's this force in a room that's clearly malevolent, and we don't know what it is. But it also, even though it's in a fantasy world as well, you are covering divorce and whether it's possible for a child to get two adults to communicate and compromise. There's some very real world themes in there. I love the, I love the fact that the kind of rival girl is this sort of, you know, sort of posh or dismissive character, but then we actually see some depth to that, and we get some understanding of why she's like that, and those two characters actually then become friends, which never, you know, usually in a book there'll be a posh, horrible, dismissive character who just stays like that, and they're just the enemy, and, you know, go, why is that person so nasty to me? And I'm great. And there, you know, there's proper like examination of why someone would be like that, and whether privilege is a good thing or not, and you know, those sort of
freedom. And that kind of like, why would you want to be? You want to be this person, but then actually, why would you want to be this person?
Yeah.
Of what they're putting forward. Well, that's very gratifying to hear. Thank you, because it's you know, I found parenthood to be just the most extraordinary psychological. It's like doing a PhD in psychology because you start to realize that, I can't remember who told me this, but it's like the only thing that stays the same is change. So just when you're getting the knack of something, it just, aha!
Yeah,
just a fun style. Ah. and then you get to sort of the age that my daughter is now, sort of the 12, almost 13, and it's on a daily basis that your finger in the wind trying to find why something is the way it is, and so much is going on that you are not privy to. I think that's the other thing, like sort of middle school. I don't know what you call it in Britain now, but sort of those first 2 years of last year of junior school, senior school, that transition is just, there's like Russian novels being written between people, between groups of friends every single day. And I find it, I wanted to do something that felt like it was at least vaguely legitimate psychologically for that age.
And I think that's good. You know, I think it treats the reader as intelligent as an adult. There's some fun stuff. There's some very fun. You have some fun with the footnotes. I was just reading one.
You're
explaining what a spork is in quite a tense moment. And then you go, "What are you doing? What are you doing down here? There's a fight going on." So you know, there's fun in the fun with those footnotes, and there's sort
did
of
you find it interrupting your flow, or was it a welcome aside? Would you say
I liked it because I think it's sort of your voice coming through, and it's you know, it's sort of, I kind of like the stepping away and acknowledging that it's a story. Sort of acknowledging it's a story, that there's a storyteller, but also then you go back and you're right back into it. I mean, it's absolutely it's a high paced, lots of action, lots sort of thrilling stuff, houses exploding and monsters
absolutely
taking people over and all sorts of things to enjoy that kids will love. I mean, my son's a little bit too young for this book, but I think it would. It sort of would appeal to him. He loves being scared, but you know, but gets easily scared. But he loves ghosts and, you know, the idea of other creatures and worlds. And I think this it is this sort of it's got a real original feel to it, and it's got this real sort of tension there that as you're reading, you're going, oh, what's going to be that? And it gives you a signal lesson into why you should always read the small print in terms and conditions.
Well spotted.
Which are there right to the beginning. So it's, you know, it does feel like it's going to be part of a long series, and it obviously ends.
That's the plan. That's
ends
nice
on a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
So have you been commissioned to write more than two?
I have not more than two at the moment, but I'm obviously working on that. It's one of those things where you want to there's two worlds, right? There's Edinburgh and there's the fantasy bit, the middle market, as it's called. So those are two opportunities to get into the second book. And in the second book, you know, the middle market comes to Edinburgh. Like Ailsa goes to the middle market in book one, the middle market comes to Edinburgh, a bit like comedians coming to the fringe. not quite as malevolent as that, though. And I think that, you know, it's my opinion that you only really understand what a book is or what your story is when you get to the end.
Sure.
And then if you outline, and then I got to the end of the outline and went, oh, wait, that's what the story is. And so I went back and revised the first third. So I'm sort of a third of the way through.
Okay.
Half of the way through, publishers listening. And really enjoying it. And And I'm not having the second album pressure that I had when I wrote the grown-up books. I felt enormous pressure. And in fact, I think in my second adult book, if you read the last three chapters, I was in real time writing them at the speed at which you're reading them,
right.
Not with Dragon Dictation, which is sort of, I remember Dragon Dictation, you had to read it Alice in Wonderland. You remember that? Like the old days of the,
yes,
when you had to teach your AI what you sounded like.
Okay.
And I spent a whole day reading Alice in Wonderland to Dragon Dictation. And then at the end of the thing, I went, okay, I'm going to dictate a letter. I put my feet up on the desk and went, "Dear John." And then the little thing of death went for about a minute and it went, "Dijon." Like, I must have, fuck this. Back to typing, RSI be damned. But I guess, I mean, now we've got AI writing our stories for us.
Yeah, exactly.
Delightful news. I put in, "Who is David Wollstonecraft?" into ChatGPT, and it said, "David Wollstonecraft is the writer and director of The Honorable Woman."
Okay.
"No, I'm not." And then it apologized. It's very disturbing. Anyway.
And then, "Oh, it's you, shit."
Yeah, oh, sorry. Everybody be quiet, he's here.
So you're inevitably going to get, I mean, I feel like with the extra hour, there's quite a lot of faff to get to the extra hour. I don't know, you've got to live in Edinburgh, right, to get in there. And you've got
for
to
now.
Go.
I mean, it's a franchise. Obviously. Okay. It's going to be like, you know,
they'll make it open other places. And
yeah.
Then you've got to go. There's quite a lot of admin to do before you get in. But what would.
It's a club, Richard. It's like, you know, getting into Century on Shaftesbury Avenue. It's very. Not just
what
anybody.
What would you do if you did have an extra hour, David? You're going to get asked that a lot. So I'm going to ask
I
you.
Know,
you're ready,
I know.
You're ready.
It's, I have my pat answer, which is that I would probably sleep.
Yeah, that's my answer too.
But I think the creative answer, well, the promo answer is I'd go and see Bleak Expectations at the Criterion Theatre,
okay.
Opening May the 3rd. But I would probably say I'd cook dinner. That's the thing, because okay. When I like to cook, but I get impatient with myself. I always think, God, if I could just do that little bit of prep, do something with, I don't know, recipes that take time. Are fun to do, and for my family, I think I'll probably do that.
Nice.
Probably, which is pretty, you know, non-epic, but at the same time meaningful.
And would it be worth the consequences of what happens when you
killing everybody on the planet? Yes, it would. It would. Food is very important, Richard.
That's very nice. That is a very lovely thing. I read in the front that your adult novels are possibly going to be made into films. Is there any news on this? This feels like a very filmic idea.
There is some smatterings of interest. I'm sort of letting, you know, the laws of deal physics do it, go with that. But it's very gratifying. There's definitely some interest. So it's who knows? I mean, it's. I think it's particularly when you're writing the second book, it's not good to think of what that then might become, because then you start to influence what you're doing and it feels you'd sort of be stepping across two stepping stones instead of one.
Sure. But, you know, then you do a film series, then they'll open up a big world where you can go and experience all this stuff and you get lots of money. Then you could have some controversial political views.
Yes. Well, yes. I've got my views set. They're ready to go. They're oven ready. But I do need the roller coaster first, I think, for sure.
I think it's very much its own thing. I think if you're going to compare it to any popular children's author, I would say it's more in the area of Philip Pullman than anyone else. But which is a nice area to be, I think.
Thank you. Well, no, that's extremely flattering to say. I mean, I would dream of having my fingernails on his coattails, but I think I don't know. It's funny how you've written a lot of things. All the personality of a book, like with your autobiography thing, that just came out because that's obviously passion and important and personal experience. Creating a fictional world, you're putting in. I think Steve Mangan was talking about this, about, you know, his thing about kings and queens and anti-monarchists, whatever it is, but sort of pushing in stuff that you realize it's like a process of discovery. You realize what your opinion is on something.
Yeah.
I'm not somebody who generally goes out and tells people to their face, here's what I think about this or that. It sort of permeates through the story or the characters. And I think that's what's been really gratifying about the women in science thing just emerged out of going, my dad was a scientist when he was alive. And there was and he had a lot of these very talented women working for him who never seemed to break through. And yeah. As a kid, I'm just watching that going, how come all the guys are getting, but all the, you know, and so it just sort of was a natural progression, and yeah. It sort of teased out my own opinions on things. So if, you know, this is just a vehicle for my evolvingly controversial opinions about life and how to organize society, then great.
Yeah.
If I can keep doing it, because it's really, as I said at the beginning, I think scripts are easy for me now. I know how to do it. I know at least the rough draft is easy for me. I know the way it goes. But with a novel that's 70,000 words or 65,000 words and no more, you just have to. It's like this endless Tetris of trying to. No, you can't go there. I've got this file called Offcuts that's like a Russian novel worth of like weird. Scenes and sequences and thoughts, because yeah. You're just chopping it down to the quick, and I find that really quite liberating as a writer, because it's just hard. It's hard yeah. to muscle it in, and the idea of kids reading, it's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but it's such a complex thing, because you create a world and there's a lot of elements to it, so it's even for you to balance that, but you also have to make it understandable to the reader. So like if you're felt like Lord of the Rings had that big map at the start, and you sometimes would get confused about what was going on. But I think this does, you know, you do successfully create the world, and you do know what's going on in this quite complicated world that you've created.
Well, we do have a map now. I don't know what edition you saw for the proof, but the it comes out on June the 8th, and there is a map.
Oh, good.
And there's a sort of cast of characters graphic, which is beautifully done by Alicia Trufio. So it's like there's this very cool navigational aid.
Yeah.
That you just go, okay, here's the real world characters, here's the fantasy characters, here's the map, go.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of off to the races, I think.
I think that'll help, but I just was impressed that you could do that. I can't picture things in my brain anyway, so I've got a slightly odd way of reading.
Really?
Books. Yeah, I can't. So I've got, well, I can, but it's a different, I can't see pictures in my, I've got aphantasia. I discovered during lockdown, that's what I discovered. So I can't see things in my head. And I always thought I could, and I sort of can in my own way, but I wouldn't be able to picture a map. I still have an idea of what I think the middle market looks like and where it goes and what, but it's not like an image in my head. So I don't have a cinema in my head. Most people do, obviously. It's about 1% of people don't have that.
That explains, because you have the facility of like sort of your comic creations. Like I went back to Time Judgment, please, by the way, just when you post that thing about 21 years and watched episode one little bit. It was Al Murray, like a baby, like a tiny baby, just absolutely nailing it. And I would say that sort of the verbiage of your output and Fist of Fun obviously is not as visual, I would say, but can be made visual. But sort of the fountain is situational and witty and funny and all the good stuff, and it's just, it's really, and I would say that I'm the same. I have to force myself to be more visual.
Yeah,
it's easier to be verbal, and maybe that's just a function of having started in comedy briefly for like 30 seconds, next picker please, but the maybe that's part of the challenge, was writing something slightly different or slightly like not the same palette.
It's a very interesting world, and as I say I love the complex ideas. I think if your kids do talk to you after they've read a book, they might not do. There'll be some conversations to have if you read this and your kid. And I think adults will enjoy the book as well. I don't think it's obvious. I don't, what age is I always find that difficult to work out. Is this aimed at sort of 12 to 15 year olds? Is
would be
my guess.
8 to 88 is the idea that it's middle grade, higher middle grade, I think is the. But I would say, yeah, anything above 8, if somebody's comfortable with a bit of spooky atmosphere. But,
yeah,
you know, there's there's no terrible things that happen really, I think, I don't know, I think there's enough adventure and deeper themes to get the older kids still engaged, but there's enough fun fantasy and that sense of what would you do with an hour in the day. I've done some schools talks, and that's just, it's such a powerful thing, because of course it's always like I would play the following game or I would do this, but if you say, okay, well, imagine that outside of that, it's about where do you give your attention, where do you give your the stuff of life that time is. It's like if you're going to give that to something, what is your area of focus? And then suddenly you get these really profound 8-year old answers, and obviously some scatological ones, but generally it's like it's quite beautiful. So I think that there's, I think because that is a relatable theme, no matter how old you are, and obviously the older you are, the more relevant it gets. I'm really interested to see, you know, who does buy it, who picks it up, and where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tragedy of the passage of time and the preciousness of time is, however much. I sort of feel like, you know, why did no one tell me that I would eventually
be old?
And then you go, of course, loads of people told me, but I just completely didn't listen. And you can't really make a young person understand. I mean, this hope for this book might.
I think you've just described the reason I wrote this book. I think, thank you, Richard. Hours of therapy. I just needed half an hour with Mr. Herring. But I think that's why it's. I read somewhere that kids experience time as a landscape, not as a conveyor belt. It's like you can go to different places. That's why, you know, I remember getting my daughter out of the car to go to nursery school. Took about a day for her to get out of the car and then seeing something on the ground that was suddenly the most important thing.
Yeah.
And it's like this compulsory Zen Buddhism that parenting is. Maybe that sort of was the inception point, but to teach kids the value of time when you're that age where it's infinite, and you don't have really control over your own time in the same way that we do as grown-ups, and then we go and squander it, is kind of interesting.
We do. We squander. You
know, sorry to get a bit.
Then we're too old. Your teeth are falling out, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. So yes, read this book while you're young. Appreciate being young. We're both stuck in Edinburgh in the 1990s, wishing we were still in our 20s, and we no longer.
It can still happen, Rich. I believe it.
We'll go
never
back.
Say
we'll
never.
I'm going to walk around in Edinburgh, go through every little passage I can find, and hope I find a route back. That would be nice.
Yes.
Would it? I don't know. Probably not. Are you reading anything else, David? Do you read a lot? Is there anything you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Oh, yes. I went back to the City of Ember series recently, which is sort of an old classic. And I really enjoyed Steve Mangan's The Escape Rooms.
Yes, yes.
I would say that's a classic example of children's fiction that goes into deep theme. But very smartly, because it's a card trick a little bit, and then you just gradually realize what the theme is, and there's the whole bereavement thing going through it. So I thought that was wonderful, and I would say that at the moment I am so jet lagged I can't really recommend anything else at the moment.
Okay.
I've picked up Ben Miller's Boy Who Fell Into the Fairy Tale, which is excellent. Anything with another world, and I know it's a kind of common theme in kids' fiction, but in Skandar. I mean, Skandar, there's a new Skandar coming out, The Phantom Rider. I absolutely love that. It's A.F. Stedman. I think it comes out in the UK quite soon.
Okay.
And that I can highly, highly recommend. Freaky unicorns, and it's a phenomenon, I would say. That's something that I stand back and admire.
Terrific. Well, look, it's really lovely to see you again, David. I do recommend The Magic Hour. Do pick it up. It's, you know, that it's already been touted, admittedly, by your publisher as a modern day classic.
Oh, gosh.
But I think they might. I think they might be right. I think they might. So, really good luck with it, and really great to see you, and good luck with this with the next one, and I'm sure the next 10 that will come after that.
thank you, Rich. Lovely to see you.
Really lovely to see you. Thanks to Chris Evans for all his hard work on this. We'll be back next week with I'm not sure actually. Probably maybe might be Josie Long next week, but let's find out. We can just tune in next week. We'll see. Thank you. Bye bye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.